Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today for this special classic movie review, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello!
We also have Bill Graham.
Who, hoo, hoo, hoo.
And we have a special guest, Nate Fisher. Nate?
Hello. Hi, everybody.
Hello. Why don't you tell the fine people at home a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, all right. I am an extremely freelance film critic and podcaster. I do comedy in and around the Los Angeles area. And I'm very glad that we are talking about the movie we are talking about today, as it is helping me relive or connect with my inner 18-year-old.
Oh, interesting. And that movie, of course, is Stalker. The 1979 film from Andrei Tarkovsky, and we're going to talk about it. This is our first, technically our second, but I'm going to call it our first, because the second was more like a commission, and this time you're getting it because you gave enough to our Patreon that you deserve it. Hooray! Speaking of which, you can help fund this series on patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Patreon, which was going to make a dumb change to their payment structure and has decided not to. So, hey, now is as good a time as any, literally, because everything is going to be staying the same. Patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Get access to our Slack channel where you can talk with us. It's been pretty active the last couple days. I've definitely been neglecting like most of my actual life obligations to be a part of it. It's a good time. You also get involved in raffles and stuff that we're doing. We, of course, are also brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage. There, you will be able to get a new film every day that lasts for 30 days, so you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films to watch. Great films, old films, foreign films, new films, indie films, and a couple of famous films. A really good example of that, currently they're going to be screening This Is Spinal Tap, the seminal comedy classic.
The funniest movie ever made.
Hell yeah, man. I always find it hard to even like bring up Spinal Tap for the same reason that I find it hard to bring up like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Because I feel as though just saying those names, you're like contractually obligated to spend 5 minutes just throwing quotes back and forth.
Shark sandwich. Oh my god.
There's a part of me that really wants to get a full, like, one sheet of shark sandwich and just put it up on a wall somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's just good design. But anyway.
I saw a tweet somewhere that said that the Twin Peaks Red Room was the perfect synthesis of the covers of Shark Sandwich and Intravenous de Milo.
Oh my god.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Podcast over. Now that my mind has been suitably blown, I don't know how I'm supposed to go forward. But anyway, if you at home have no idea what we're talking about, get your free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage, and you can understand the wonder that is This Is Spinal Tap, as well as the wonder that is Mubi. So that's it. The only thing we're talking about today is Stalker, because this is a special episode, and we're not going to have a spoiler section. Presumably, the natural course of a conversation will mean that most spoilers will be reserved towards the latter half. But if we feel at any point that we just want to scream out the surprise twist ending of Stalker, we could do it. So if you haven't seen Stalker, get on it, I guess.
The funniest movie ever made behind Spinal Tap.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was in stitches on my couch for the full 2 hours and 42 minutes. That is Stalker. I'm also not going to play any trailer because it's either going to be silence or people speaking in Russian. And not to generalize about our audience, but I'm assuming most of them don't speak Russian. So what would the point be? So let's talk about it. Nate, why don't you kick us off? This movie brought you back in time to your 18-year-old self. What are your basic thoughts on Stalker?
Yeah, so Stalker was one of those like high watermark movies for me when I was young. When I was like in that period of like being a young person watching a ton of movies where you're just like throwing back, just going through countless, just like a high art house, like classics on DVDs from the library. And I think the one that hit home hardest out of all of them was Stalker. And it was a very weird experience because I was, you know, I was about 18. I was, you know, having one of those kind of like, not midlife crisis, but what the 18-year-old equivalent of a midlife crisis is. And I was like, you know, very curious about very big philosophical questions. And I think that more than any film, Stalker gave me the kind of like return to like my core. It really shocked me in a way that I walked out of Stalker. And I remember saying to people in only the way that really pretentious 18-year-old kids can is like, yeah, I want Stalker. And it turns out I believe in God now. But I really meant it. And I revisiting it now, I've seen it once or twice since then, but revisiting it now, I was like, oh, I could feel not the same things, but I could at least feel some kind of analog to that. In a shortened way of saying that, it's an extremely heavy film that earns its heaviness in spades with its, you know, latter half hour.
All right. Phil Graham, lover of long movies.
Oh, no.
What were your thoughts on Stalker?
So I didn't read much going into this film. I didn't quite understand what I was getting myself into from the get-go. And so a lot of this film was a complete and utter surprise for me. Shockingly, this film is way too long. That being said, I do think that at times it gambles and it actually has a lot of payoffs. There's a lot of philosophical kind of ideas being thrown at the screen. The three main characters talk at length at times, almost agonizingly so. There are extended monologues. And if you can find yourself through them, you may end up with kind of an interesting kind of exploration of a lot of these different topics. Because of the sci-fi element, because of the kind of art house vibe that it has, and you know, all of these kind of intermingling things, it's hard to kind of cut through and really say if this film is super self-serious or if it's just serious enough to like make enough sense. So this film is not an easy watch by any means. It is 2 hours and 45 minutes around there, give or take. It also does not do much in terms of trying to quicken the pace. This film is rambling and it takes a long time to get going. It takes a long time to get where it's trying to go. And so it's, upon reflection, a interesting journey, but while watching it, you're forgiven more than likely if you are kind of in agony. As I was throughout a lot of this film, I was just not even sure where or what it was trying to do and set up. So, you know, I come out the other side and I'm shockingly amused that I took some things away from this nearly 3-hour film.
Usually I'm the last one to go, but I just like to say that I would like to vehemently disagree with everything that Bill said regarding this movie moving slowly.
Or so you don't think it's
to get where it's going.
It's too long.
No.
You think you want more?
I don't know if I want more. All I know is that the movie as it exists is the perfect length. Because it is how long it is, and the movie is great. So, when we began this classic experiment, there was a question as to what counted as a classic movie. Because this is an old movie, and many people hold it in high esteem. Does that make it a classic? Possibly. I was thinking we would go towards more like the kind of movies that even your mother would know about. You know, the Casablancas of the world, if you will. And so when we decided on Stalker, I said, oh, great, a nearly 3-hour long obscure Russian film that, you know, why would we do this? But I went and I watched it because I do like Andrei Tarkovsky. I'd just never seen this one. And I was entranced from the first frame, and I was drawn in as though by a spell in a dream. And every scene seemed to have so much happening within it, even as the characters were keeping their motions and their words to a minimum. And there was just, it was like living in the world. And I know that that is a very cliched thing to say whenever something is long. It's like, oh, it lets you soak it in. But it does. And the places that this goes and the mood and the tone that it sets immediately, it gets its hooks in you. I also found myself thinking about the people who sat behind me when I was watching Blade Runner 2049, who said, this movie is 90% walking. And they meant it in a bad way. I would love to make them watch this movie. I would love to make them, you know, see from whence all that walking comes and to see if perhaps they would understand it better, because every step that these people take is done and filmed and framed with so much intention that I felt as though I were on a lazy stream and it was moving me towards something and I didn't know what it was, but I was excited to get there. And
this movie is 90% walking and then punctuated with 10% lying in the grass.
Yeah, there is, yes. There is 10% chunk in the middle of the movie.
So there's
lying in some grass.
I'm going to jump in there and say it's plenty exciting for me. Sorry. Keep going.
Yeah. Fuck you, Bill. but anyway, so that's kind of my thoughts. I was not thrilled about seeing this movie, I will say. I figured, oh great, here we are in the film stage show, being snobs again. Even our classic movie reviews are obscure and shit. But, no, this is unpretentiously, cause I get accused of that. This is a great film. This is a really beautiful film that I honestly wish that I hadn't waited so long to see. But Michael Snydell.
By the way, Twitter voted for this. It's not like we picked it.
I know, and I think yes. That says something about the people who follow us.
Sure. So it's going to be popular
even an
with
option
them.
To begin with.
Spinal Tap Twitter.
I do want to mention one thing. It is currently sitting at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, God damn it.
For fuck's sake.
I'm not doing this.
Better than Lady Ow.
Yeah, it's better than Lady Bird. On IMDb, it's an 8.1 out of 10 with almost 81,000 reviews.
Mm.
Which to me is honestly like a much bigger compliment to the movie, because people on IMDb suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to know what it's next to on like the IMDb list of movies. Like it's next to like Harry Potter 8 and like, I don't know. Batman Begins.
Well, anytime that Christopher Nolan puts out a movie, it for at least a day is the number one movie on IMDb's top 100.
That's but anyway. Awesome.
Michael Snydell. Why don't you tell us what you thought of Stalker?
Yeah, I'm way more positive than Bill. Probably not quite as positive as you though, Brian. Okay. Yeah, what I'll say about the pacing is I think the pacing is completely deliberate and is exactly what it's supposed to be. Like, you're supposed to feel that length, you know, for the first 40 minutes. Can I say what happens at the 40 minute mark?
Fuck yeah, man. Do whatever you want.
All right.
This is a classic episode. This movie's almost 40 years old.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Well, spoilers for a 40-year-old movie. At the 40 minute mark, after it's been in kind of this sepia tone, it switches to color when they.
Yes. Imagine my surprise. I was like, whoa, what's going on here? Did something happen to my TV?
But it's the moment right before that that I think kind of defines this movie, where it's about a 2-minute scene where there is this serene rhythm of kind of train tracks, like they're on a tram traveling into what is known as the zone, and you hear the kind of squeak and patter of the train tracks, and it's close-ups of their face. And then after about 2.5 minutes of that, it just cuts to color and we're in the zone.
It is shocking.
And it's a fantastic moment.
How long that shot takes.
I'm sorry?
You forget how long that shot takes. You're like, how much time just passed? I have no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I found out that's like a notorious shot because it's so long. And I, upon reading that today in anticipation of recording this, I was like, is it? It didn't, like, it felt languorous in the moment, but then because of that hard cut to color, it felt, I don't know, something like it transmuted somehow in my memory. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not enough time to prepare you for that paradigm shift.
Well, I mean, I wanted to speak about that specifically because I must unfortunately admit that I had to watch... I had to stop about an hour and a half in because I was incredibly tired the first time I watched this. Mm. So I had this bizarre experience of leaving this like plaintive but also disorienting movie and coming back and being reminded that it's far stranger than I even thought it was. And I think that's where weirdly it kind of clicked for me, is being able to see the ways this like does this slightly off kilter, like naturalism and like this bridge between like total plainness and surrealism is where I think this movie like finds its greatest power for me. Like in the things it has to say, both in the monologues as well as in the shots about like the spectrum of nature. I don't know if that makes sense. Like the ways that it changes so like capriciously, but also in ways that feel, you know, defined by something else. And I think that's when I found the most power in this movie. Now, what I will say, this is my third Tarkovsky. I like Solaris and Mir is one of my favorite movies ever. This is probably my least favorite of the three, only because I don't think that the monologues were integrated as well as in something like Solaris. Like, I kind of knew, this being Tarkovsky, I knew there was going to be those languorous, you know, sequences, and I knew there was going to be, you know, some discussion of philosophy and ethics and morality and like conversations that literally move from like nihilism to the opposite of nihilism in 10 seconds. And like, I found it fascinating the way it kept mutating, but there were definitely times where I did just want like the weirdness of this environment to tell that story a little more. And I do think at the same time, some of those monologues are, you know, they're almost accompanied by this code in the way that it goes back and forth between sepia and color to like maybe indicate flashbacks, maybe to indicate some like parallel realm.
Yeah, there's some time change stuff going on in this, in the middle of this film that I was very confused by.
I think I'm still grappling, especially with the last 15 to 20 minutes as well, which with that character, which we can get into later. So overall,
Mike, we can get into it now, sir.
Yeah, man.
no spoilers are going to be left unturned in this one.
No, I just feel like I'm prattling on. I wanted other people to talk. That's all.
Well,
you're going on a Tarkovsky monologue. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, just say a poem. I'll insert the sound of a babbling brook for 7 minutes. And then...
Jesus.
Initial thoughts, just what I want to say is I don't think that this, as well as something like Solaris, and especially for me, which I find like a much more intimate and personal film, which is why I was probably more okay with the monologues than that. I think that some of the dialogue in this was a barrier sometimes, and I did just want it to just be able to tell its story. And I understand that's a signature of Tarkovsky, but I was definitely distracted at a certain point. But that being said, I mean, I think this finds a weirdly satisfying ending. And then I guess the last weird thing I want to say is what this reminded me more than anything, was The Exterminating Angel by Buñuel. So I don't know if any of you guys have seen that, but that's what this weirdly reminded me of. And like just the fact that I'm comparing this potentially really self-serious movie to like this satire of like bourgeois culture, I don't know, that just says a lot to me about how I think it's easy to interpret this movie as this like self-serious somber meditation, but I think there's something a lot more playful and weird and kind of unknowable that makes this a lot more fun.
Yeah, I'm seeing that what you're referencing specifically in the parts where like the birds fly into the sand and then disappear, or like when the phone rings out of nowhere, then they answer it and then realize that they answered the phone. Stuff like that is very like, it's the art house slapstick that is so endemic to like Buñuel or other directors of this time. No, I can completely see that.
I was going to say, it's funny that like we're talking about all these high-minded ideas behind it and this concept of like, well, you got to get through all this other stuff to get to the interesting part. Because I think even just on a surface level, on a surface story, it's a very, I don't want to say fun. It's engaging. I felt engaged and curious throughout this whole movie. We haven't even talked about what the plot is because we don't have to, because this is a 40-year-old movie, but I'll do it anyway. So basically you've got the main character who is the stalker, and that's his job title. And he is guiding a writer and a professor who go by writer and professor.
Nate is our stalker today.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good point.
Dare you wish on me. That guy's life sucks.
You don't want a child that's named Monkey
and can do telekinesis. That'd be kind of tight.
Whoa, spoilers. Oh, wait, that's not a thing here. I'm just really excited that we can talk about whatever we want. But yeah, no, it's so the stalker is taking the writer and the professor into an area known as the Zone, where something happened a couple of decades ago, and it has left this area dangerous, uninhabited, but apparently with a place known as the Room, where... Your dreams can come true. You enter into it and your wishes are granted. And that's the movie.
Isn't there something about like how the reason that the stalker is able to basically navigate there is because I'm trying to figure out like exactly why he's the one that is able to navigate beyond just the fact that he's able or he's been there before.
It's
a lot of the rooms like shape and change based on who is there and who is witnessing it. You know, who is leading the charge versus who is staying behind, what kind of objects you have in your possession, whether the room or the zone itself will take action upon you based on, like, do you have a weapon and, you know, things of that nature. And so there's some kind of sentience to the room beyond just, oh, it's going to give you what you hope. No, it's not like a magic genie. Well, I mean, in some ways, yeah, it kind of is a magic genie because it does have a mind of its own and it's going to give you what it thinks you may want, but also kind of slightly underhand you in many ways.
Yeah, there's a lot of unknowns in this movie. For instance, what the hell created the zone? There's a claim that it was a kind of meteorite. Maybe it's aliens. Maybe it's something else. This is based off of a novel that I now want to read called Roadside Picnic.
Yeah,
which is aliens in that one, I believe.
Banana's name, by the way, Roadside Picnic. and this film is based on that. I don't know how the hell the Roadside Picnic turned into this movie.
This is a road movie.
It is, yeah.
It's a very it's a goal-oriented road movie. It's by far the most linear of Tarkovsky's films. If you haven't seen the other ones, they get a lot worse and the monologues get a lot longer.
let me ask y'all this, because you know, I had a hard time kind of finding my way through this film. I don't think the link does any favors in my favor in particular.
Because you have the memory of a goldfish.
Yes. But I am curious if y'all had run into Tarkovsky before. Mike, I know you had.
Mirror.
Yeah, yeah. Brian, it sounds like you had.
Solaris and Mirror, yeah, I've seen.
And how about our guest?
I've seen all of his films like a couple times.
Oh, wow.
I mainly meant before you jumped into this film, your original viewing.
Yeah, I watched Andrei Rublev and Solaris first.
Oh man!
Then I watched this.
Just dove into the deep end.
So what I'm kind of getting at is that y'all set me up for failure. y'all should have given me some other movie before this to help me along my way, and then we could talk about this one. Because I was feeling real confused and real lost throughout this entire film.
What would you
film.
Have wanted us to do? Would you like us to say, Bill, in addition to Stalker, which is 2 hours and 42 minutes long, you should also watch Solaris, which is 2 hours and 47 minutes long?
I don't know what the recommendation would have been.
Start with Soderbergh's Solaris and then work your way back from there.
I mean, maybe that might be an idea.
Here, right. You can do what our guest did and watch Andrei Rublev first. That's only 3.5 hours long.
And there's no color.
There's no color? Even if I hit my TV hard enough?
Yeah. Bill. No.
Okay.
That's not how set you moving. Up for failure. That is really passing the buck, man.
Okay. Anyways, okay, let's move on.
Yeah, as I was saying, I think on a basic story level, this is a good movie. Even without all the other cool stuff, like this could have been a silent film of just watching the process and like the intentionality of these characters moving through this alienish landscape. And I would have been just as riveted. I think that all the other stuff that comes up might even detract from kind of the quest nature of the film, while at the same time giving it a lot more than it would have otherwise had. But I mean, this is a weird time, honestly, for us to watch this movie, especially us three for the first time, because it comes on the heels of Blade Runner 2049, which definitely had a similar, you know, let's watch this character walk down this hall type of thing going on. And then we're also getting it a couple months before we get Annihilation, which is another nameless characters go into an area that may or may not have been taken over by aliens. That is a kind of verdant nature reclaimed wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
And that just lets you know how much this movie has like affected both the aesthetics and the themes of science fiction as well.
It's a profoundly influential film. We talked earlier about like whether this constitutes as a classic or not. I think that in so much as it has spawned an entire festival circuit genre of imitators and a world style that prioritizes, you know, 3-minute shots over everything else, I think this is like more than rocketed to a kind of classic status. And it also is helped along by the fact that it has that sort of epic narrative quality to it of a faraway objective. I think where that sort of tension between the sort of like epic narrative that you were talking about and the kind of rambling, you know, philosophies and metaphysics of this is in the fact that the setting for that sort of narrative is so counterintuitive. There's a point where the stalker says, yeah, so the thing that we're trying to get to is like 200 meters away, and you've got an hour and 50 minutes left. And it's it was great. No, it's really great because like it really gives you this kind of, it puts every step into context. Every literal step that they take is suggested that it is not exactly what you're seeing, and that what they're seeing is entirely different. There's a lot of manipulation on that front. So I kind of love how the sort of the wires are getting pulled out and played with on this sort of just linear progression. That sort of storytelling device is very ripe for philosophical ruminations, for lack of a better word.
And this,
the other thing too. I'm sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Michael.
I just want to mention this in relation to, you know, Blade Runner, and I know less about Annihilation, obviously, but I want to mention specifically that even something like Blade Runner has more explicit stylization. I think what makes Stalker so interesting is the fact that not only is it like expansive and it's this epic quest, but that it leaves so much room for your own projections and for you to bring your own baggage, that even the monologues, while they're about, you know, these, I hesitate to say characters because they're really archetypes. It's a professor, a writer, and the stalker. And each of these characters like has general malaise and failures that they're dealing with, that the monologues that they're saying are general enough that they can either be applied to the culture at large or obviously like the specific plights. And I think the fact that it can represent both of those is what partly makes this, you know, to go back to what Bill's saying a little bit difficult to get into, even in a way, Solaris kind of has this too, as I think about it, but just like, it's not only the languorousness, but just the fact that there is so much space, quite literally, as well as like in interpretations, that makes it difficult because there's not even that easy thing that you can grasp onto, because even then you don't actually know that the quest is bullshit. Like I think it's so weird because I've been weaned on so many adventure movies that I half expected, you know, when they threw the metal nut, you know, to try to find a trap. I have expected, like, you know, there to be a mine at some point.
Yeah, I was honestly expecting, I don't know what they're called, but like those giant claw rakes that you see sometimes in movies or video games that like snap up like a bear trap.
Or like they go through,
Brian,
and like
I lost you.
Logs swing down from trees and like smash into each other.
Yeah,
like,
hold on. I think we lost Mike.
Oh, did we lose Mike?
I'm back.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, I really truly was expecting like danger, and like for all I know, in the past that guy has had to deal with that.
Sure.
And I just think that makes like the non-activity of their progression so much more tense and interesting.
Especially when you counter it with the fact that they got literally shot at before they got to the zone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Scary.
I think one thing Mike brings up that scene, and I found that scene really riveting and interesting because we never do actually see into the corridor until much later. And so the entire time they're talking about, you know, they've kind of rounded this corner and they're looking kind of towards the camera, looking towards the camera, looking towards the camera, and you never see past them or see past the camera, and so you don't see what they're seeing until much later in the film. And so you're just like, well, this could be anything that they're looking at, you know. are they actually seeing danger, and that's why they're wanting to throw this big metal bolt or nut down this hallway, or is there something actually there? And so I found that pretty interesting and pretty curious that, you know, the way that shot is filmed and, you know, it's set up and it's kind of blocked.
If I can offer a fan theory on the bolts, I think that a lot of the psychology of the film, the psychology of the camera choices are meant to provide to give you unease about what you're seeing. And I think that the bolts, among other things in the film, are meant basically so that the characters can see that what they're about to step into is what they're actually walking into. It gives that kind of like groundedness.
That's kind of how I felt. Like, okay, I'm going to, because their action with the bolts is like, we're going to tie a thing to the end of it so we can see it. We're going to throw it. The bandage will let us know if anything weird happens in the air. And then one of us is going to walk to it. And once they find it, the rest of us will follow. Cause there's this feeling, and in a modern movie, and I, you know, maybe this isn't fair to modern movies, but I feel like in a modern movie, at some point you'd have that thing where someone turns around, looks at someone, then turns back and the camera follows them. And then when they turn around, suddenly it's like a desert.
They're dead or something.
Yeah.
Or, oh.
I was
okay, or that,
like,
sorry.
Or someone would step and then like you'd kind of see like the world shimmer and suddenly they're in a whole new place. And in this, the danger felt a lot more grounded. Because of what we were saying, those camera tricks were like, they're looking through something and being like, oh boy. And then the scene by the kind of like aqueduct waterfall where the professor realizes that he's missing his rucksack, and just the way that the sound is and the way that they seem to have entered and then left the same place and come back, but now there's a sign from a previous expedition that's there. It's a kind of tactile, it hues so close to reality that I was just that more unnerved by it.
Well, I think, Brian, you're kind of touching on this a little bit, but I mean, we all have to admit that this film was, you know, released in 1979. So the tactile kind of feel of it and things of that nature, I don't think there's going to be much shimmering in 1979,
I mean,
you know?
Bill, I mean, they had special effects. Like, when was Close Encounters of the Third Kind? Like,
yeah, but they didn't have like CG special effects that we have now. And
color
and
forms,
that's,
they had cross editing. Like,
yeah,
I mean, fucking Star Wars, bro. Like,
well,
yeah, but what do they always say about the original Star Wars trilogy, right? They
Too
say
many
that
words.
It feels tactile. No, they say that it feels tactile.
Yes.
And they feel like it's been lived in. And why is that? Because it was fucking real, man. Like, you know, the prequel trilogy is ceremoniously, you know, sideswiped because it feels brand spanking new. And that's because Lucas was like, well, I got all this technology now. So
when I say tactile, you know, though, I mean even just beyond like the sets and the setting. I mean, like,
sure,
just
but,
the weight of everything and the way that the world works around them.
It's hard to like, Brian, I think it's even less like a shimmer than just the way that whole thing is edited. I mean, you look at a contemporary around that time, like, you know, like Nicholas Rogue or something, like he's someone who would. He's the complete opposite, would constantly be cross-cutting and editing, like, and it has less to do obviously with like any early CGI, but like a tactile feeling that you're watching something as it's meant to be, but then it does something that doesn't like meld with how your mind understands nature. Yeah. Like that's what it was for me, I guess.
Yeah, Tarkovsky also like loves mud. Like his favorite thing is shooting mud and shooting water. It's his like signature shot. And you can sort of draw a through line between the depiction of like those elemental forces and like the kind of consciousness of the zone in a very sort of clear way across the narrative. And I think that it motivates a lot of the water falling from the sky and motivates a lot of the sort of like shifting, you know, plate tectonics of the actual space that the characters are in.
Speaking of the water falling from the sky, I think one of the things that made this movie not feel boring to me is the fact that in every scene where we're spending a lot of time focused or kind of directed towards a single thing, there's always something happening in it. So there's this incredibly long scene where a man is walking down, I guess you'd call it like a sewer pipe. It's right before they reach the room. And it is peppered with these holes in its roof that are just dripping water and appear to have stalactites hanging down from them. They're like the calcium deposits from just the endless dripping. And you just, I mean, I don't know. I won't say you because it might just be me, but I was hypnotized by it. And I was just staring at this and just, I could like feel myself getting sucked into it. And then within that same scene, we get that editing that we were talking about, because there was a moment where the way that it was shot and the way that the camera was moving, you're on this person's face and then you're watching the people who are supposed to be following him, and it appears as though they've lost him. Like they're just walking down this tunnel so much further than they ought to have to in order to find this man. And then suddenly he was back and they could see him. And I was like, I kept expecting at some point for one of them to say, like, man, you guys, like, you know, I've been waiting for you two for like 2 hours. And they're like, what are you talking about? We were right behind you the whole time. Like, that's the kind of strangeness that the editing is able to create, in the same time that I'm so drawn in by the rather banal strangeness of this world that he's created.
Well, all of this stuff, like, makes me just really fascinated about the behind the scenes of how the sets were created and how this film was kind of made, and how, if a lot of this stuff was stumbled upon or if this was, you know, wholly created. You know, I'm looking through kind of the Wikipedia page and they're showing some of the set locations and stuff like that. And I'm just fascinated whether those stalactites, you know, I would hope to God that nothing alive looks like that, because that would be scary as hell.
Well,
but, maybe in Russia.
Well, I was actually going to say Rees Park on which is right next to the Rockaways. if you're ever in Queens, New York, Rees Park is an old like public beach where people could go and park their cars and then walk to this giant like beach. It's like a giant brick castle where they were changing rooms and everything. And the way to get to it, you had to go under the road. And so they made a pedestrian footpath under the road. And when I went to Rees Park in the middle of winter, because I'm weird, those kind of like calcified stalactites were like hanging down from that place. It is the right amount of water seepage and people not deciding to knock them down, because in Rock Creek Park, actually in DC, there is a tunnel through a hillside that sometimes gets those same things. So it's possible. Nate, it seemed as though you were about to address what he was talking about.
I'm really glad that we brought up the actual production and location shooting of Stalker. Is anybody here like vaguely familiar with like what this was and like what happened?
Chernobyl?
Yeah, it's basically, so this the film was shot on areas that were heavily irradiated and basically abandoned industrial sites. And a lot of the stuff there was just as is. and they shot there for a very, very long amount of time, and everybody involved got cancer, including Tarkovsky and I think his wife, the lead actor, and, you know, scores of the crew. As a result, Tarkovsky died 7 years later. Yeah.
Damn. I was not aware of that part of the production. I do know that he like had to shut it down at some point and then basically just reshot the entire movie.
Yeah, that I forget the story behind that, but that is ringing a bell. But I do know that this film basically killed him and everybody involved in it.
That is insanity.
It's watch it again with that in mind, and it's really sad.
The funny thing is, though, is like watching it, I'm like, is this a movie worth dying for? And like part of me really wants to say, yeah, like if I had made this movie, probably. Michael, to your point, though,
yeah,
the Chernobyl disaster, whatever you want to call it, was 1986. And I have a really sad story about why I know that, if you want to hear it.
Sure, Brian, go ahead.
Okay, this will be quick. So as a child, my mother would work at a doctor's office in New York that she'd worked in before we moved to Maryland. And so my dad would go to work in D.C. And so on Monday and Tuesday, I had to have a nanny. My sister and brother and I had a nanny. This nanny was from the Ukraine. She had a daughter who was in my grade. This daughter had a glass eye because the government had told everyone that even though the Chernobyl meltdown had just happened, that it was totally safe to be outside in the rain on one particular day shortly thereafter. And it was not. The rain actually rained radiation down on these people, and my nanny was pregnant at the time. And so after she escaped the Soviet Union and got to America, they were actually able to treat the degenerative disease that her daughter had from being irradiated in the womb by the rain around Chernobyl.
Jeez.
Yeah.
I found out when Chernobyl was from playing Call of Duty 4 and the ghillie suit mission.
That's not as cool as my story.
We all learn in different ways. And
yeah,
different
man. We all come to God in our own special ways.
So, and in this so case, apparently,
God is knowing when Chernobyl is.
Apparently, Tarkovsky shot Stalker 3 times and then consumed over 5,000 meters of film. Yeah, and so I think one of the main areas is Tallinn, Estonia, and they shot near a half-operating hydroelectric or... What is it called? Hydro something. Hydrophonic? Where is it? Hydroelectric station. Yeah. Oh. And then up the river was a chemical plant. So that's yeah. A lot of the crew died.
Yeah.
That is insane.
That is I get it. That'll happen when you do that. The other, you know, I did a couple of readings. Luckily, because this movie was newly restored and released this year on Criterion, a lot of places found it necessary to write about it. And almost every single one of them had the same anecdote about the Soviet film higher-ups having looked at the movie and saying, it's pretty slow and dull. And Tarkovsky apparently responding by saying, it needs to be slower and duller.
I kind of love that there's like a scene right at the end that is like explicitly condemning capitalism, and I'm like, oh, there it is.
Look, as long as you just say fuck the capitalists once, we'll let you do whatever you want.
That's negotiation 101. Ask for 4 hours and when you want 2 hours 45.
Yeah, exactly.
Tarkovsky knows capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, that's like the thing that every Hollywood director who's ever gotten away with anything from the MPAA says. They're like, yeah, I put in like this really brutal evisceration scene because I just wanted to be able to have a girl say fuck once. So I don't know. I kind of
want to go back a little bit. Bill, I'm still kind of more curious about the things that you liked about this, because I'm curious about what engaged you and where it lost you. Because I can understand why, but I'd definitely like to hear your experience.
So it was just the monologues?
Yeah, the monologues. Man.
Let me ask you something. If the monologues had been replaced by more bolt throwing and slow walking, but like this, the time remained
I want
the
that
same.
Cut.
Like, would you have been okay?
Yeah, like do the monologues over those sequences, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, so you want like a Terrence Malick-esque whispery voiceover?
No, not so much art house as that. Just
a whispery voiceover, but it's three Russian men yelling at each other.
That actually sounds like my dream movie.
It's mainly the monologues that kind of lost me, but interestingly enough, I think it was by the second time, whichever one was set in the water where he's just like laying down in the water, and I think there's a wolf or some kind of dog like looking at him the entire time. That one I started to kind of catch on a little bit and try and kind of revel in what it was trying to do. But the first one really lost me. And so, I mean, as far as like what I enjoyed about this film, a lot of it is just like kind of the concepts and ideas of the way it's shot and just kind of looking at the production of it and, just kind of submitting myself to the beauty of it because it is a beautiful film. And I was just really intrigued by everything that was going on in the film and kind of how it was playing with time and space. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it reminded me a lot of like Lars von Trier, except not as like horrific, because he does a lot of things where he takes the kind of mundane and makes them horrific. And in this film, you're looking at basically what are like what I can imagine are just abandoned power plants and tubes and things like that. And Tarkovsky kind of is never really kind of explicitly like developed or even like kind of dug into. Instead, it's always kind of on the surface, and so you're not quite sure if it's their minds that are just going haywire, or if it's something about the actual scenery around them that's not quite what it should be. And so that's kind of a lot of what I really dug from this film, and really kind of got out of it was just a lot of the kind of interesting side notes more than anything.
I'm glad you mentioned Lars von Trier because I'm sure he himself would be very happy at the comparison. The last shot of Antichrist, if you'll all recall, the final kick in the nads that movie delivers is that it's dedicated to Andrei Tarkovsky.
Wow.
I don't remember that.
It's dedicated to Andrei Tarkovsky, and I screamed at the television when I saw that. But to go back to your point, I think if I can defend the monologues and kind of like build on what you said, like I think Tarkovsky hates the monologues almost as much as you do. I think what he's doing with them is he's trying to just dramatize the process by which, you know, the zone's mental warfare that it wages on these people causes these very compulsive talking men to break down, and they break down real time. But what they also do at the same time is that they're trying to break the stalker down. It's because these guys are like, these are Tarkovsky's like stand-in parodies of the intellectual totems of European culture. And he wants them to be exposed for the just rank predatory jerks that they are, and how they sputter with their sort of nihilistic and venal nature, and just they ruin a decent man's sense of faith. Like he spends the most of the last 10 minutes just like breaking down, and his wife has to console him. And that's like that can be argued that it's less successful than, you know, the more picturesque parts of the film. But when it's delivering home the kind of what I think is like a theological underpinning, where they're talking about the why they wouldn't go in the room and why the guy that hung himself, that was the stalker's friend, did go in the room, I think that it kind of justifies it in that regard and gives it the sort of the oomph that I get from the end of the film.
Mm. Do you think that's possibly why, actually speaking to what Bill just said as well, that he does kind of hold on these conversations without giving us some like other visual stimuli?
Yeah. He's very, very, I mean, the choices that he makes are, he doesn't exactly like, you know, linger on a close up for each like time a guy's talking. He does a lot of different things, and it's difficult to explain each one of them in detail. We don't have enough time, but
sure.
I do really like how he frames each of those arguments and, you know, what sort of like frames within frames he puts around these people, or how he has them situated towards the camera. They all tell a story and recontextualize each of those lines because those lines are kind of meant to be viewed with a degree of skepticism.
Mm.
So I want to ask what we think about the end of this film. Let's start with, well, there's a lot of ends. Let's talk about that final moment outside of the room.
Mm-hmm.
When I think in the only part of this movie that could be said
the
to
slow pull out, is that, no, what we're talking about?
I was going to say the only part of this movie that could possibly like be said to be like a Michael Bay film. When one of the characters randomly pulls a nuclear device out of his backpack.
Ah. Okay.
Yeah. And then everything that follows from there. Okay. What are we to make of that? Like, what did we all take away from it? Because honestly, when that nuclear device came out for the first time, I was like, whoa, left turn.
You didn't see Chekhov's bag of socks hanging on the wall in Act One?
No, I did not. I was curious. I was curious about like where the movie would possibly go from there. Cause I was like, all right, Soviet film about a room that gives you anything you want. Yeah. Maybe the movie ends with them blowing it up in a nuclear explosion. That makes sense to me.
I think honestly, I don't think that wholly works, but I want to say what I like. I do like the way this comes back to Porcupine and his brother,
mm-hmm.
and the notion that he wanted money more than I already forgot. All right. That the room gave him his subconscious desire, not a conscious desire.
Yeah.
And therefore like, you know, only acknowledges our deepest desire, which is indecent. Like that humans are inherently filth, I think is what the professor says. And I think that's interesting, but I think I was less convinced by how quickly the scientist gives it up. How quickly the professor decides to dismantle it, especially given the rest of the movie that they're constantly having these, you know, kind of bickering conversations. And this is kind of the point where they're finally having it. And I think the stalker's breakdown is very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But I was surprised that the professor was so quick to dismantle the bomb. It lost me a little bit there, even though I like that element on paper. But I think that's also comes back into, I just don't think I could get past the self-consciousness of this dialogue. And I really like what Nate says about how we're supposed to take some of these monologues and the dialogue with skepticism, because I was doing that and I wasn't sure if I should. But I still think that some of that dialogue is like overly, not pedantic. Why can't I think of the word? Compelling. It's a D word that I can't think of.
Yeah, I think
didactic.
There we go. I think to speak to the when the professor chooses not to blow the place up, I think the writer, and this is where the actual like dialogue or his monologue is incredibly like salient. And I knew that this was Tarkovsky speaking with more fervor than he was earlier when he had his other character, when the other characters were talking in a more like roundabout way. But when he sort of lays out in rank detail that, you know, Porcupine, the guy that hung himself before the film, went to the room, and all he got from the room was money, because the room revealed to him the thing that he wanted most, and it showed him the barrenness of his own soul. And I think that the point that gets hammered home really, really powerfully, at least in that moment, and then the very ending undercuts that, but the point that gets hammered home in that moment is that the room itself is kind of a paper tiger, and that like it doesn't do anybody any good. It's not the super weapon the professor thought it was. It's not the thing that will throw society into a tailspin, because it already, like, society gets itself into a tailspin just by its own very nature. Yeah. And that's all the room kind of reflects back to you. It doesn't give answers to the people that come looking for answers the wrong way. And because the professor can't see the capacity for the answers there, he's like, oh, people are going to come here and get screwed on their own. I don't need to destroy this. This thing is useless.
Exactly. Because he's like, what if a wicked man were to go in there and like wish for world domination? It's like, sure. Yeah, but it's not going to give him that, because like deep down, maybe all he really wants is like, I don't know, something a terrible and dumb. I was about to say someone to love him.
He wants a sled pack.
Yeah. I'm actually kind of, what do you think the room would give you? Open question, and it's probably the most destructive party game that anyone could ever play.
I think that the room, as I visualize it, is the Criterion Closet, and I get to go in there, take as many DVDs as I want, and then they put the video of it online, and everybody likes it. That's what the room's given me.
But see,
only DVDs?
But so,
not Blu-rays. Only DVDs.
I was about to say the room you would walk into it, you would take all those DVDs, but then after you'd left, it would give you, you'd open each one and it would only be like a copy of Big Mama's House.
Fucking monkey paw.
Because again, the room gives you what you really desire, not what you consciously desire. So you go in there and you're like, yeah, I'm going to look real highbrow. And then you open each one and it's like Big Mama's House. No. Because I was thinking about that.
It's like a 4-hour cut of Big Mama's House too.
Tarkovsky
cut.
Part of me was thinking like, maybe I would go in and it would give me money. And I was like, but I really want money. Like, you know, as a man living in this modern capitalist society, I could, with a wife and a child, I could use some money. So now I'm wondering, like, would the room sense that and then instead give me like something darker? Like, what deep base animal instinct would it give me? And I was like terrified of what the possible answers would be.
I do like the idea of you going in and giving you $4,000. Like, it gives you money, but it's like I'm so poor that I'll take $4,000. You know,
honestly, I'll take $4,000. Yeah, that's fine with me.
I want nothing more in this world than four grand.
Woo. $4,000 isn't life changing, but you know, it'd make the next couple months easier.
I'd buy a nice car for $4,000. Right.
So, Michael, what do you think the room would
give
you?
Oh, god damn it. You know, if it could, like, get rid of neuroses, that would be pretty helpful. So, I don't know, like...
But that's what you'd ask it for. What do you think it would give you? Do you think it would make all of your neuroses true? Like, if you're the type of person who's like...
Oh, no.
Like, so let's say you're the type of person who has delusions of being, like, let's stalked. Like, you're one of those people who feels like the world is out to get them. And you go into the room, and what you want is, please make me, like neurotypical or something. Like, make me the type of person who's not constantly afraid. But what the room intuits is that you really just wish you were right. And so it gives you a cabal of people who are constantly actually following you.
It does really kick ass to be right.
Yeah, right? Like yeah. Would you rather be like, okay, I'm no longer worried that everyone's going to get me, or, oh shit, everyone is trying to get me. I get to tell everyone who told me I was crazy that they're wrong.
Both of these scenarios sound terrible. The room sounds terrible.
The room is a terrible place.
That's what the professor realized.
Yeah. It's great. Bill.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of anything clever. But Bill, while you in.
Can I say, while you guys are thinking, I'm really glad that nobody's made a room, the room joke yet.
Hi, Nate.
So it is timely. I've been trying to think of one, actually.
Or a room tearing you apart?
Yeah.
I was going to say something like, you go into the room expecting that it's going to give you what you want, but then it just tears you apart.
They make a movie about the making of the room called The Nuclear Disaster Artist.
Oh, God.
A lot sadder than the James Franco film.
Yeah, because it ends with Tarkovsky dying. How old was he when he died?
I'm gonna look this up. 55.
Oof.
Yeah.
No, it says he was 54.
Go ahead.
Mine would probably be... Mine would probably end up being that I go in there asking for all of my favorite foods, and then it instead only picks two and gives them to me for the rest of my life, which I would inevitably end up like hating after about a year. Cause that's how long it would probably take for me to start hating them.
I feel like we're not on the room's level, cause Porcupine went in ostensibly to try to save his brother, but what he got was money. Mm-hmm. So like what Bill would say is like, I want to go in and like be able to have all this food that I like. But then perhaps, you know, you would come out and I don't know, like you'd be able to eat all that you want without ever like gaining any weight or anything. But then also at the same time, you wouldn't be able to like become any more fit. Like you would just
hit the room just trying to get a McChicken, and all they gave me was the ability to fly. This sucks.
That would be great if you went in with like a really modest goal and then you came out and you realized you were basically Superman, and it's just like, oh, I guess I'm the one person on Earth who benefits from the room.
Bill,
Then you, if you ended up being Superman, you would just end up being this miserable sack of shit because you couldn't save everybody. So
then you just
be pissed off about that. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna make a bad joke. Go ahead.
No, make the joke.
Go ahead.
Go for it.
Join me. Make bad jokes. Come on.
All I can think of is that Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode where Homer has the donuts and the devil is feeding with the conveyor belt and he just keeps eating the donuts.
I thought you were going to talk about the Monkey Paw episode when he gets the turkey sandwich.
Oh, the turkey sandwich, yeah.
Yeah, no, not when when he makes the turkey sandwich and he's like, lettuce, tomato, mayo, the turkey's a little dry. The turkey's a little dry! Like, that was his Monkey Paw coming back on him. Anyway, so let's we figured out the complexities of the room, and it gives you the thing that you subconsciously want, your dark desire that you really don't even want to admit that you want. So it sucks. But let's talk about Monkey, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to go first? Nate, you've lived with this movie longer than the rest of us. Why don't you kick us off here? What do you think is going on there?
So I can basically, like, Tarkovsky is a very symbolic filmmaker. I think that this last scene as a laundry list of symbols is kind of doing it a disservice, because the actual experience of watching it over the course of a couple of minutes is incredibly like thrilling and enlivening. But basically, it's all the symbols that we've seen sort of that referred at various points in the film kind of coming back all in at once. Like, we saw this kind of like really dingy reality that the stalker and his family lived in, where the train went by their house every 12 minutes and it made all the glasses on the table shift around. And then we also heard, though we never actually like experienced it, we heard the people talking about, you know, music and reasons to live, like, you know, being able to give to your family, like the stalker was happy about, or music, like the stalker was happy about. But, you know, he had to get all of these things taken away from him at the very end of the film. And he lives this very miserable life, as we can only assume, going on. But in spite of that, Tarkovsky gives us this scene where all of the stalker's, you know, stated desires kind of all come together in this sort of miraculous moment that sort of sneaks in to the reality where Monkey, the daughter, born of the zone, uses telekinesis to move glasses across the table before the train comes to the house. And it's in that split second, you're like, it's sort of like a secret between you, the viewer, having this very personal moment with the film itself. And that moment, which happens in perfect silence, suddenly gives way to the Ode to Joy in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And I can't speak. That was my I believe in God moment. I was like, well, the act of believing in God is therefore justified because of this scene. I really did feel that in the moment. A little embarrassing, but, you know, that's who I was. Sue me.
I will. You can expect to hear from my lawyer.
Okay.
Michael Snydell, what do you think of that?
I'm still processing what Nate said. That's fascinating, and I feel really stupid because I didn't get any – I wasn't able to collect the symbolism in the way that he did, and I didn't even think about the timing of the train and her psychokinesis. I think – all right, I'm not going to let what he just said spoil the bad thing I thought it was. I couldn't tell whether this was a flashback to when everything, you know, looked like the zone. I also for a second wondered if that was the mutant daughter that they spoke of who lost her legs, like as one final I didn't recognize her as Monkey, which is my fault, but I wondered in that moment whether it was like a final thing that there is some, I'm going to speak really generally here. There is some hope or optimism here, you know, regardless of how you interpret the room and its nature and intentions, there is still possibility here. And your skepticism is not welcome here. Like that, there is something in finally showing someone doing something in front of our eyes with no trickery. There is a confirmation there. Yeah. Which as Nate says that I can see it as it being a higher power. I'm not sure I went there, but I definitely did see that as some optimism or confirmation of a movie that's kind of constantly teetering back and forth.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most nakedly optimistic endings in any film. It's like a miracle up on there with like Dreyer's or Debt, and I think no other film. Like no other film commits to optimism from the depths of its own negativity as loudly as this does.
And yet she looks incredibly depressed and like put down by the weight of the world. Like there is something in her body language where it seems like she wants to be anywhere else in the universe.
I was curious about that because, you know, usually in a movie like this, you know, like when Dorothy comes back from Oz, everything is sepia again. And so it was curious to me that suddenly they were in color, but they appeared to be out of the zone. And I just, I was, I, you know, coming as it does at the end of his like breakdown and then his wife talking, I wasn't 100% sure what to do, because compared to the rest of the movie, the end of this film is a flurry of activity. And
it's pretty strange. Yeah.
I felt like my brain had been rewired to not act as fast as the movie was suddenly acting. Yeah, so I was like sitting there and suddenly this woman is doing this, and I'm like, so did he go in the room? Did she go in the room?
Yeah.
You know, did the girl go in there? Are they all in the room? Like, he talked about bringing them back and making a home in the room. Is that like, did they decide to do that? And when they like wished that their daughter, you know, maybe perhaps like wasn't crippled anymore, and instead they made her somehow extraordinary.
Also, we're breaking the fourth wall for the first time in the entire movie right at the end.
Yeah.
That's true.
But I agree that I found it to be optimistic. Whatever possible thing was happening there, I felt like it was an affirmation of the faith of the stalker in the possibilities of this place.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I think that it's the child, because they talk about like what happens to children of people that go into the zone. I think the wife mentions it, and this is just yet another one of the many chilling parallels between the making of Stalker itself and the actual text of the film, with the sort of, you know, the poisoning but also reality warping effects of nuclear radiation or things of that nature. And that's why part of me thinks that like the zone is some kind of nuclear analogy. Maybe I've just been watching a lot of movies with the atomic bomb in them recently, but that's kind of something that I've thought about, especially this time watching it around. But I do think that it's like, is her ability to perform, you know, moving this glass, is this kind of radical, like, cinematically over the top manifestation of like the goodness and capacity for familial love and altruistic love that the stalker did by giving this girl life and, you know, caring for her. And it's a very, it's like, that's it, as a counterpoint to the illusory nature of the zone, we have the clarity of this observed miracle. And I think that like makes it, I don't know, it dares you to approach it in only the most reverent and naked tone. Like, this is like me being the least ironic I've been all episode, but it really is like the kind of thing that encourages the maximal response. I think that's why so many people like me have such a very, very, like, very pronounced reaction to this film. It's got the followers of Stalker are up there with the followers of any film in terms of like how much this movie means to certain people.
Yeah, I could definitely see kind of sinking into
the
this
cult
movie.
Yeah, there's a book like just about like some writer, I forget his name, but he wrote a book called Zona, and it's like just an entire like memoir of his experience and his relationship with specifically this film.
Well, and there's like a lot of offshoots too. There's like loosely adapted stuff inspired by this film and the book before it, and all sorts of things that are kind of, you know, have expanded this universe in a way that maybe not, you know, directly, but indirectly in a lot of different directions. So, you know, I can imagine that you keep kind of sinking back and wanting to reread the original text in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And Zona is by Jeff Dyer.
Hmm.
Just in case anyone out there in listener land is curious.
I used to know who it was. I don't anymore.
Bill, did you have a comparable interpretation, or what did you make of that ending?
I don't fucking know.
I was
confused by that because I was watching the bar sequence and I was trying to focus in on what was going on, and then I was so focused in on her kind of mental breakdown and her agony. And by the time that scene kind of rolled around with its kind of quiet solitude, I was just like, are you fucking kidding me right now? She's moving something with her fucking mind. Like, what is this movie? And so, yeah, I was amused, but I was also like intrigued, but I also had like no fucking clue what to make of that at all. Because this film, so much of it, like I had mentioned, was like not doing that on the nose shit. And the end is just so blatantly on the nose. And it's, you know, it's you watching this thing happening while this girl like pushes a glass around a table, and you're just like, really? Like, this is what we're going to end on? And I mean, I guess, yes, it's in some ways it's optimistic, but I found it such a weird kind of endpoint for this film, from everything that it had kind of done and held back in reserve to that point. I think it is curious that it is the youngest among them that is doing this, and maybe, you know, that kind of touches on some of that optimism as well. That while all this shit is going on, it's the youngest among them that has kind of like the brightest hope. So,
All right. This movie is 2 hours and 42 minutes long. I'm sure that we could talk about it for just as long. Nate, you've been living with it, and obviously, I assume, speaking to other people about it, and yet you've performed ably on this, but we should wrap up. So,
wait, I wanted to ask one last question to Nate.
Wait, can I move the glass table around the...
It was a glass on a table, Bill, yes, not a glass table.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I was gonna ask a final question, but Michael, I'm curious what yours is.
It might be the same as yours, Brian, but okay. I was just gonna ask Nate, did you take away anything significantly different from this viewing that you hadn't previously, or I'm just wondering if anything changed? I assume you've seen it since you were 18, but I'm just wondering if you had a different experience with it in any way this,
you know,
time.
It's like the film says, it's that you know, infants are weak and soft, and they are beautiful, and old men are hard and frail, and they are bad. And I think that my old hardened heart finds less to be joyous about, or at least does not experience the same kind of like reverie that I did when I was a teenager. I can feel myself getting older and sort of more ossified. And it was a very sad film to watch again because of that. But also, I think it gives the emotional core of the film, which is really there. We talk about the philosophy of the film and the kind of like the cinematic tricks of the film, but at its emotional core, it's a film about deeply dejected middle-aged people living in a dystopia. And I think that though I am not middle-aged, the older I get, the more I register that part of the film, and the more that rises to the level of the other things I noticed when I was younger.
Well said.
That's, we cut it off there.
All right. Nice, well, nice. Any final thoughts or ideas or comments about Stalker before we wrap it up for today?
Did I take your question, Pran?
No, but it was a more interesting question than mine was.
Well, say it now.
No, I'm just going to claim that my question was, does anyone else have any other statements before we go?
Well, now you can ask that.
I did, and no one said anything, so I'm going to assume that it's over. And yeah, Stalker. I'm just going to say it's on Filmstruck right now. You can get it on Criterion Collection. And despite my misgivings before seeing it, it is indeed a classic. There's no way to argue against it. This is a great movie that has influenced a lot of cinema. And don't be put off by the time. Don't be put off by
the time. I've seen it even in a couple of movies this year. Like, I was thinking about The Untamed and Lost City of Z at a few different times during this.
I was primarily thinking of Roadrunner. Roadrunner 2049. Blade Runner 2049. But yeah, Lost City of Z. Lost City of Z is a good one. And again, we're going to be getting... You know, if we had any common sense, we would have waited to do this, like, right next to Annihilation. But we didn't. So it's coming out now. It's coming out now. 2 weeks before Christmas.
The height of awards.
All right. Well, that's it for today. Let me remind everyone again that you can give to us by going to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. This episode, actually... Let's give all credit to the people who give to our Patreon, because you gave enough to get us to our first little, I don't know what we call them, reward tiers?
Incentive?
Yeah. Tiers.
Tier, yeah.
An incentive is good, tier. And that's why this is happening. So if you're listening to this and you haven't given any money to our Patreon, you know, just send out a tweet and be like, thanks, Patreon givers to the Film Stage Show. You gave me something for free. I am a freeloader. Yeah, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. In addition, MUBI. We've gotten done talking about the laugh riot that is Stalker. Don't forget that MUBI has This is Spinal Tap coming out soon. So if you've ever wanted to truly capture the sights, the sounds, and the smells of a rock band on the road.
Ew?
I mean, you've seen the movie, right, Michael?
Yes.
That's a quote
but
from
still
the movie.
I don't like that sentence.
That sucks. Talk to Rob Reiner. That's MUBI, MUBI.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. That is all for today. Hope you've enjoyed this bonus episode. Nate, thank you so much for joining us. I gotta say, considering that the three of us had just seen this for the first time, I think that having you as our own personal stalker into the zone that is Stalker.
Wait, does that make me a monkey? A fuck you guys.
You are not
that is, or the bolts. You might be the bolts.
Bill is the bolts. Yes, I am definitely the writer.
Can I be the waterfall?
Yeah, I guess. You really want to be the waterfall. Can I be the meat grinder?
Sure.
Yeah, fuck you.
That's pretty accurate.
I'm switching to the tanks then.
Okay, you can be the tanks.
Podcast is the meat grinder.
All right. Nate, why don't you tell the fine people at home where you can be found on the internets?
You can find me on Twitter at Nate Media Good. You can also find my podcast, which I have just started, that I am very happy to share with the world. The podcast is called Body Double with Nate Fisher and Nate Fisher. Me and one of my best friends, whose name is also Nate Fisher, talk about movies we agree about. It's a lot of fun that we're on Twitter at Body Double Pod, and we are on SoundCloud and iTunes.
That is an insane.
That's amazing.
That's an insane idea for a podcast.
Yeah, we have similar voices too. It's like hard to tell us apart. It rocks.
That sounds so.
What's the most recent agreement?
Well, we just did a movie. We did an episode about movies about the atomic bomb that is currently in the can. Nice. It's come out hopefully tomorrow. And then we're going to be doing a wrap-up for 2017, a two-parter, where I'm going to talk about my top 10 of the year, and other Nate's going to talk about the only 10 movies he saw.
That's amazing. Now, here's a question. Have you yet reviewed 1984's Body Double?
That's actually – so we have to do one for next week, and in lieu of having a better topic come up, I think that's what we might end up doing.
That nice. Is amazing. Okay, Bill Graham, what about you? Where can the world find you between now and the next podcast?
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG, trying to figure out how to involve more monologues into my life. You can also find me writing for the film stage. I'm sure I'll have some stuff up for the year-end list and the best of. So looking forward to that.
All right. Michael Snidell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snidell, where I'll be trying to find my own zone each and every day on the Hellscape. That is Twitter.
It gives you what you want, Michael.
Well, then I'm a bad person. All right.
Yes.
I will probably do some year-end stuff for the film stage. I think documentary stuff is coming up, is going up either later this week or next week. And then the last thing, I want to do a plug for the Chicago Film Critics Association, who just announced all their awards last night for the year. So check that out.
Lady Bird, really, Chicago? Come on. Anyway, you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. I am writing some stuff for the Film Stage's year-end stuff. I think I just turned in my movies that exceeded expectations. So keep an eye out for that. And, of course, Letterboxd. Yeah, that sounds like enough. I don't need to tell you anything else. So that's it for today. Nate, once again, thank you for joining us. And, ladies and gentlemen at home, join us when next we meet. We will be talking about Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
No woo for that, Bill.
Woo!